This transition won't just happen at the local or regional or national level. It will implicate sort of global supply chains, which will then have impacts in other countries. And there are sort of energy justice, climate justice dimensions to those impacts that are important, and some of which involve the, so who bears the costs of the transition, not just economic costs, but social costs as well. And I wanted to get your sense of how this is sort of goes back to Morgan's point about how complicated all this is and how humble we have to be about how we think about it. It's almost like when I think back in the 70s when we talked about ecology and ecosystems and being humble about trying to assume we can understand the full impacts to an ecosystem of touching it in one location. This is kind of an analogous problem here. But I'm wondering if you have ways that are helpful for listeners to sort of frame or think about the energy justice, climate justice impacts of these of this sort of global change that's going to happen as we move to a cleaner energy mix.
I'll just say one word, but I think Dustin's done a lot more work than I have on environmental justice overall. You know, I think while I said that everything's deeply interconnected and we have to broaden our system boundary, at the same time, it's the case that we do not have a homogeneous set of sovereign states in the world. And of the roughly 200 countries in the world, there are dramatically different conditions in most of them. And so how their institutions and governance and cultural norms and societies choose to engage on this issue there's going to have to be an allowance for multiple pathways towards this inclusive transition. And, you know, if at least in emerging and developing countries, if you ask them what their priorities are, and they don't have to write it in a public document, but you ask them what their real priorities are, climate change is not going to show up in many of those countries in the top five. And so that's actually why this approach to just transition might be even more important than we've highlighted here, because in their top five will be poverty, education, food, health, and certainly, you know, maybe clean energy and energy services and clean water will be in there also. But if we can make this approach inclusive enough to allow for countries that are not prioritizing climate change in their policies or with their direct investment, but are prioritizing poverty alleviation and public health and gender equality, et cetera, it's just a different approach, but it could get to the same kind of place. So just one thought on the justice part, but I'm not a scholar like Dustin is on that topic.
Well, I can add a couple things. In a 2013 paper in the Geographical Journal, we set up just transitions on three legs. And the first leg was energy access, because usually when you enter into these conversations, that's really where this goes. And I think that is echoed by what Morgan just said. Energy access for those who lack the qualities of energy that would give them a better life. We know that actually could have better environmental impacts, particularly in communities that might be very natural resource dependent, and this might allow them to have incomes that maybe lessen impacts on natural resources, et cetera. But key is give energy to those who don't have it. The second leg was justice for those who live in and around or work in the fossil fuel economy, and that's much of what we've been talking about in this conversation. And then the third being what we moved toward, which was to manage any contradictions that might flow from pursuing clean energy, climate justice simultaneously with all of this, meaning making sure that we don't reproduce systems of inequality in the commodity systems that we develop for the clean energy. So one of the approaches that I like to take as someone who calls himself a political ecologist. It's in the geography realm, human geography, but interdisciplinary approach. So we take an approach called commodity chain analysis, where we elaborate and try to walk through all the stages of production. And I think from a framework, a research framework, what a commodity chain allows you to do is it creates comparisons within the chain. You know, we tend to compare countries, we tend to compare industries and things like that. But if you draw out a commodity chain and you say, okay, this is a green job here in the United States installing solar panels, let's walk through each stage back into the supply chain. Where do we end up? What does that job look like? You really create a framework where you can look at comparative environmental justice along the supply chain. And it's those relationships that our society has created ethical blind spots, right? I talked to solar industry. I've been interviewing and getting surveys on chemical use and all the best practices in the solar industry for over a decade. And I've been asking about tin. Tin is a conflict mineral. It's in most solar panels. No one knows where their tin comes from. It's impossible to trace. It comes from a smelter somewhere, but they don't even know which smelter. And where does the smelter get its supply from? Good luck. No one knows. So having that framework, and I think this is really important because with the pursuit and the overwhelming, with the pursuit of clean energy and the overwhelmingness of climate change, we've given what I call in my book, Solar Power, a green halo to these technologies. And we don't allow for critical inquiries into these systems. And that's the most concerning part for me, is that if we don't keep a keen eye towards what these systems of production are going to look like and don't plan for them adequately, deep in the supply chains, we might have very, very dirty jobs linked to very, very, what we're calling here, clean energy jobs.
So in that piece in the Geographical Journal, you make an analogy to the kind of problems in the oil and gas industry we associated with the resource curse. Basically, the idea that the benefits of resource extraction flow to a few and the poorest and the many tend to bear the costs most of the time in a lot of particularly developing countries where oil companies have gone in to extract product. And as somebody who's had a look at the way the super major, the super big companies try to deal with this issue, my impression is that despite what seemed to me to be sort of sincere efforts to be part of institutions that try to force a fairer distribution, there's only so much you can do from the outside to influence that within another country. Do you worry about that? Is that part of what you're worrying about in connection with with production of green energy in a worldwide supply chain?
I think that does capture it. It's that our supply chains are pretty invisible, and they're incredibly complex in some cases, particularly when you're talking about metals that have, you know, a handful of smelters that might be pulling from all parts of the world. So yes, I think that's really the concern, is that the systems of production we've created are erased from what we see. And that hasn't changed. That I don't see that changing yet in our clean energy in our clean energy systems, and I don't see the conversation yet elevated to a desire to accept in some parts. So we have corporate social responsibility initiatives. We have efforts to try to build the ethical battery, right? The idea that let's try to get sourced from places that we don't necessarily reproduce systems of inequality. But even that becomes incredibly complicated. Like, what do we do about these artisanal miners? These people need incomes. So it's a very, very complicated term that it just needs more attention, I think. I think there's just not enough attention to it. There's not enough conversation around it. And I think part of the complication here is that the climate is just such an overwhelming voice that other impacts don't necessarily rise to the same level of concern. So people will say, you know what? Oh, well, we're going to die unless we, we're all going to fry unless we develop these things. So let's not worry or get bogged down in the justice questions. Whereas I think Joshua and Morgan have made it really clear that the potential for building coalitions here and building better support for these things are definitely there. So it's just the absence of conversation, I think, that is the most worrying to me, in the lack of criticality and desire to investigate where stuff comes from is still what we see out there today. So I think that captures my concern.
Josh and Morgan, we've been talking a long time. Do either of you have something you want to chip in on this?
I wanted to come back on the international dimensions piece. And, you know, I think Morgan alluded to this earlier in that when you're thinking about from a climate perspective, if you're wanting to push for a clean energy transition or sort of mid-century decarbonization goals, that's all well and good. But if you're India and you get two-thirds of your electricity from coal, you know, what is the, you know, what's the transition forward for you? Now, they have robust solar scale-up that has been proceeding since 2014, but it's still a relatively small sliver of their energy mix. And, you know, there are other concerns that may be foremost in their minds, of the minds of many people. And I'm using India as an example because I've been doing a lot of work on India. But, you know, until the COVID crisis, you know, the environmental concern that was increasingly salient in India was not climate change, it was air pollution. And so I think, you know, whether you're trying to approach, you know, communities in West Virginia about the clean energy transition, or you're trying to approach India about the clean energy transition, you have to kind of meet people where they are and be attentive to the things that they care about that are motivating them and, you know, and the needs that they have, so that, you know, you're not, you know, pushing a policy that ultimately is doomed to fail. And so in the Indian context, I've been making the argument for many years that, you know, the opportunities for co-benefits are there, but the co-benefits, the co-beneficiary is climate policy, right? We often frame, like, if you do something on climate, it may produce for air pollution. Actually, that has the logic backwards, in that if you push something on air pollution, if you do it right, it could yield co-benefits for climate change. And if air pollution is the more salient concern right now for, you know, people in Delhi who are living through, you know, the equivalent of smoking 35 cigarettes a day, then if you can figure out means by which India's future is more bound up with clean energy, and that helps them address their air pollution challenge and also helps address the global challenge of climate change, all the better for it. And, you know, we're kind of not in a moment of global solidarity of thinking about how to help each other out on our common problems, but I hope we'll get back to that. But we have to do it from a kind of source of strategic wisdom that, you know, there's a justice issue here, but there's also a strategic issue here. And I think what this concern about just transition is bringing these two ideas together, that unless you attend to the justice issues, you may not be able to deliver on your climate and clean energy goals. And so there's this sort of some strategic logic to building coalitions and approaching people where they are and the issues that they care about. Otherwise, you might never realize your grandiose ambitions for decarbonization or clean energy transition. And that, I think, is, you know, a better elevator pitch than the one I started with at the beginning of our conversation.
Yeah, interesting. You know, I was thinking when, so when a problem becomes important enough to people, everybody's for industrial policy, right? I mean, in other words, and when it came to energy access in our country, right, when investor-owned utilities were finished building out where they were willing to serve, we filled in with government utilities and we filled in with rural electric co-ops, which were essentially matching funds from the federal government, right? So we've had that kind of policy here already, because the problem was deemed to be important enough for the government to be involved in steering things. So let me ask, I know we've been talking a long time and I appreciate all your time. Let me ask a final sort of provocative question, or maybe it's not provocative, I don't know. But a lot of what we've been talking about involves making sure that we do, that we manage a transition in a way that protects all of the important interests involved, or respects all of the important interests at play, and that we're aware of them, that we try to take them into account. If a green grid is even a little bit more expensive than the current grid, that's going to weigh more heavily on poor people than it will be on rich people. I assume that's not something we want to lose sight of either, right? And I guess the question is, what kind of decision process do we use to try and balance all of these competing environmental and energy justice concerns? And there may not be a right answer to this, but I appreciate your thoughts.
This is Dustin. I'll start. I think this is going to be easier on the electricity side than the fuel side, for the reasons that we talked about earlier, which is you usually have something like a public service commission or a public utilities commission that can add a layer of protection against those vulnerable electricity ratepayers in these cases. But that's not across the country, and that's certainly not across the world. So I think your point is really important. It has a lot of geographic complexity. It's not something I worry about in California, because I know we have a very, very strong policy to help people in this state pay for electricity if they don't have any or don't have the resources. So I know that we help folks there, and I sometimes can make generalized statements, but I'm really only talking about California, where those institutions. So if you're worried about people's ability to pay for electricity, there are mechanisms in public utilities commissions to help protect those vulnerable folks in some places. They're not everywhere. The fuel question is much, much more different, right? Because that's going to be something that people have to go buy over the counter or at the pump or whatever on the liquid fuel, so that you don't quite have the same mechanisms to protect vulnerable folks in those situations. But on the question of cheapness, I think our quest for cheapness is what got us here. These problems we have with pollution, with land use, with pursuing things to make it as cheap as possible, that's where we end up cutting corners. That's where we start making bad decisions about things. That's sometimes where we even are losing sight of hidden costs. Like, for example, every time I see a new utility scale solar project announcing a super low price on public lands, I'm saying, wow, there's a lot of BLM staff and lawyers that wrote biological opinions for that. And there's a ton of stuff that's hidden that's not on the private land project that actually is just a little bit more expensive, not even, you know, marginally more expensive, just a tiny bit, fractions. So it's a very difficult balance. I think we want to build an energy system that is of quality, not as cheap as possible, but that does pose particular questions for vulnerable fuel and electricity purchases.
The issue of fuel poverty is a significant issue in the European Union and across the different member states of the European Union, and has been for decades. And all of the countries of the member states of the European Union, and now also the United Kingdom, have fuel poverty policies in place. So that speaks to OECD country policies for those kind of things. And then there are, of course, other policies in place for different tariff structures and things for people who can't afford it. In developing and emerging economies, that's, as Dustin alluded to, is a much broader patchwork of responses. And often on the electricity side, there are tariff structures put in place for people in poverty who can't afford the electricity. But oftentimes those don't hit the poorest of the poor, certainly, and they're probably insufficient in a lot of those countries, even as they stand as a tariff design structure. And it has ongoing knock-on effects for the ability to invest further in the system for things like reliability that you need for building jobs and economic development. So all of these things are intimately tied, tied together, and have very different aspects between wealthy countries and emerging and developing countries. And so, yeah, your point is an important one, and how people access energy services. Certainly, you know, the list is affordable and reliable, right? Those are the key pieces of it. And so there's been lots of work on each aspect of that.
Well, thanks so much.
Well, we appreciate the opportunity.
This is fun.